Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
You know, when I first got to Segovia, I thought that the story of this mine was pretty black and white. But what the story ended up being is actually, you know, so reflective of any town in Colombia's conflict, where the line between a victim and a victimizer really gets blurred.
Welcome to Radio Ambulante Unscripted, a new way to listen to Latin America, part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm Daniel Alarcón. And that was journalist Nadia Dross talking about her eye-opening investigative piece, The Devil Underground, published by The Atavist late last year. In it, Nadia tells the story of a war between different factions vying for control of a very profitable gold mine in a very lawless Colombian town called Segovia. We meet some startling characters as we go deep into this violent underworld. And it should be noted from the outset that the mines in Colombia produce a lot of the gold that we buy here in the United States. So this is our story, too. In one surprising passage, Nadia says that in terms of violence, corruption, and profit, gold mining in Colombia just might be the new cocaine. So I began by asking her to explain exactly what she meant by that.
You know, Colombia's conflict is generally known as a drug war. And it's far, far more complicated than that, and it's far more historic than that, too. You know, one of the really strong and ever-present elements in the Colombian conflict is that so many of the things that are fought over in this conflict are actually replaceable. And if it's not cocaine, maybe it's gold, maybe it's petroleum, maybe it's cobalt. And just because of market forces and the state of the global economy, it just so happened that gold prices skyrocketed and gold became such a valuable resource, and it made so much sense for armed groups to begin essentially investing in gold. And when I say investing, I mean, you know, putting their arms and their personnel, as well as their financiers, looking towards gold as a source of income. And part of that has to do with the fact that it just became a whole lot harder for armed groups to produce and traffic cocaine. And gold kind of emerged as this, you know, brilliant way for armed groups to sustain themselves, because it was legal and it didn't carry all of the risks that cocaine does.
You point out that it's fairly easy to get quote-unquote illegal gold into the legal supply chain.
It's so easy. The way you legitimize illegal gold can happen within a matter of a few seconds, where, you know, a miner who works at an illegal mine brings, a nugget of basically gold ore in their hand to a small gold-buying shop. It's burnt down to an even smaller nugget, and it's sold to that gold buying shop. And in that moment, it becomes legal. Just like that. And these gold buying shops, you know, they, for them, what they're interested in is the gold. And it doesn't matter where it comes from. And it's a legal commodity, so they don't have to be concerned about whether it comes from a mine that is legal or illegal. They just want the gold, and then they sell it to a series of other gold purchasers and eventually refiners that melt the gold down, you know, into big shiny gold bars that are then exported on boats, on barges to places like the United States and Europe. So it very quickly becomes part of this completely legal commodity chain. And because it gets mixed in with gold that is, you know, that originates from legal mines as well as illegal mines, it becomes so difficult to actually trace the source of gold. It just, you know, becomes obscured in this very long commodity chain.
In your new Atavist piece, The Devil Underground, you focus on a town called Segovia in the Colombian state of Antioquia. Describe this place for us, will you?
This is probably the wildest town that I've ever found in Colombia. There's a lot of money that moves in that place. There's a lot of quick money. And when you have a mining town and you have a fairly migrant population, you know, people coming in because of a gold rush, because of the promise of, you know, perhaps striking gold and making tons of money, you have all the things that tend to come with these kind of Wild West boom and bust towns. You have prostitution, you have a lot of alcohol, you have gambling. So in that sense, you know, Segovia might not be so different from other towns that experience mining booms in other parts of Latin America as well. And Segovia's always been a really violent place. It's always, you know, been in the crosshairs of various armed groups who envy it because of its gold mines. And it's been involved in a lot of political violence. So it carries this history with it. And it's always been known as a lawless place where no matter, you know, how many police or military you might inject in the place, the law of the gun is what rules there.
In February of 2013, there was one statistic that you cite that I found astonishing. Well, one, Segovia had the number one and the highest murder rate in Colombia, and arguably higher than San Pedro de Sula, which is thought to be the most violent city in the world, I think, for at the height of this war, right? And just I want to put this in context because some of our listeners, you know, really have no context for this. So it was 14 times the national average of the murder rate in Colombia, or 8 times the murder rate in a city like Detroit. So we're just talking about a level of violence that sounds in your piece just absolutely apocalyptic. And I wanted you to explain this one phrase to me that you heard a lot, por algo será.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what that means in the context of a war over a gold mine?
You know, there's this idea that if somebody is killed, it must be for some reason. The war in Segovia and the conflict in Colombia in general is not, you know, one of these conflicts that perhaps is playing out, you know, right now in Syria, where there's mass bombing and a lot of the casualties are a result of, you know, bombing raids and violence on a mass level, where a lot of deaths are, you know, just accidental in terms of being caught in the crossfire. In Segovia, a lot of the murders were targeted assassinations. And so that leads to this thinking of, okay, if somebody was killed, there must be a reason behind it. What was it that they did to make themselves a target, to make themselves an enemy of the armed group who killed them? What ended up happening, and I think this happens whenever you have two armed groups, you know, fighting over the same territory, it means that civilians are caught in the middle, and anybody who lends a hand to one armed group automatically becomes the enemy of the other, and so they become a target. And I would say that, you know, most people try to avoid that situation, but it's really, really hard when, you know, an armed group comes up to you and says, give me a cow, give me an extortion tax. You can't really say no to men in arms. And so a lot of people ended up, you know, just regular citizens ended up being marked as being aligned with one armed group or another. And so that really, you know, one of the saddest things for me to see while reporting this story over the course of, you know, 18 months and seeing kind of the destruction of this town was the destruction of the social fabric because nobody trusted each other anymore.
Talk to me about some of the characters in this war. There's the Rastrojos, the Serafines, Jairo Hugo. I mean, it really is a tableau of characters that feel novelistic or filmic.
Right. Well, there's, you know, I think this story, the reason that I decided to tell it through La Roca mine and this kind of shadowy capo figure called Jairo Hugo is because they were emblematic of the different sides that were warring with each other. They were kind of representative of a far larger picture and a larger regional war that was unfolding. And, you know, basically what happened was it's the same story that happens in so many regions across Colombia where you have one armed group, and in this case it was called the Rastrojos, and this armed group, you know, emerged from the ashes of a drug cartel and combined with paramilitary fighters that had decided to put down arms but decided to pick them back up right away. And so you have an armed group which was quite comfortable in dominating a region for a few years and, controlling a population and being able to profit off of coca production in the region as well as gold mines. And then you had their enemies, a very similar type of armed group that also emerged from the ashes of paramilitarism, who decided they wanted that territory. And so as soon as you have two different armed groups, fighting over the same territory is when things start getting really, really messy.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning, I think you do a very good job of portraying Haido Ugo and all his malevolence and the scope of his power. And I think one of the things that's very well done about the piece is that at the end, I can't really say with any certainty that the Serafinas are much better.
Right.
and perhaps that's one of the most troubling conclusions of the piece, you know, because it does seem that, you know, power deplores a vacuum. And if Haido Ugo is taken out of the equation, then some equally, you know, malevolent force is going to occupy that space. And we're not sure if that could be the Serafines or somebody else. But I mean, you know, did you walk away from this feeling pretty bleak, to be honest?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the story kind of reflects my own journey of discovery, in a sense that, you know, when I first got to Segovia, I thought that the story of this mine was pretty black and white, you know, that Haido Ugo was the bad guy and the Serafinas were these victims of a terrible crime, and all that they were doing was just, you know, whatever they could to defend a terrible onslaught against them. But, you know, as my reporting progressed, you start kind of learning about the different dynamics involved. And I think that what the story ended up being is actually, you know, so reflective of any town in Colombia's conflict, where the line between a victim and a victimizer really gets blurred. And I think that the Serafinas, they could have been almost anybody in the sense that, yes, they were trying to defend themselves. They were trying to ensure that, you know, more of their family members weren't slaughtered. But they took some very questionable, you know, they did that through very questionable means. And I think that happens when you have, you have an absence of law, essentially. People take justice into their own hands. And so, in a sense, what the Serafinas did probably isn't that different from what a lot of their neighbors would have done. But it definitely does end up making you, kind of depressed when you realize that sometimes the dynamics of this violence isn't, you know, it's really based on patterns that might be inescapable. And when you have criminal groups that are so embedded in a social fabric that they can be so easily used for one person's gain and another person's loss, it kind of becomes impossible to isolate them. And they just end up being used by the population. So the population, you know, ends up being a victim of them, as well as they employ them to their own means.
It was interesting. I mean, it was, you know, devastating also, but it very interesting to read your piece kind of in the context of this myth of Colombian ascendancy, or kind of this the story that we're fed, the story that I think many of us want to believe, is that the dark days of the drug war in Colombia and the armed conflict, it's kind of waning. They're sort of in the rearview mirror. Has this story been neglected, do you think?
I think that there's been, you know, definite recognition, particularly nationally, that gold mining has become an alarming source of financing for armed groups. I think there has not been a dearth of attention, and the government, I think, is sufficiently alarmed. They're not ignoring the problem. I think that where the government has a real kind of conflict here is that The government itself has been promoting gold mining for years and years and years. And they've been promoting the legal kind, particularly, you know, foreign companies coming in to exploit gold here. And then what they end up having on their hands is, you know, this really explosive situation where traditional miners no longer often have the space to exploit gold in the same places that they did, because now there are bigger companies coming in. And so the government has tried to kind of frame this conflict in terms of, okay, illegal mining finances armed groups and legal mining is totally clean. But in reality, the lines are a lot more blurry, and armed groups who demand an extortion tax from gold mines, they don't care if somebody is illegal or legal. So I think that the entire gold industry has a lot to answer for in terms of financing armed groups. I think that the government, has a real challenge in terms of having to figure out a way to prevent the participation of the legal gold industry in this dirty financing of armed groups as well.
Nadia Drost is a multimedia journalist based in Bogotá, Colombia. You can find a link to Nadia's article for The Atavist on our website at soundworks.org. I highly recommend it. We've also linked to an award-winning Spanish language story that she produced for us here at Radio Ambulante. This interview was produced by Silvia Viñas. Special thanks to production intern Diana Buendía. The Radio Ambulante team includes Martina Castro, Camila Segura, Luis Treyes, Claire Mullen, Constanza Gallardo, and David Pastor. Carolina Guerrero is our executive director. Radio Ambulante Unscripted is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Radio Ambulante tells the stories of Latin America. To hear more, visit our website, radioambulante.org. I'm Daniel Alarcón. Thanks for listening.
Soundworks.
Soundworks
from PRI.